beyond the apparent event in itself. The operation itself could be placed in the category of special maneuvers carried out by airborne units that carried out a landing of an airborne group on the surface of the oil tanker, forcing the tanker's crew to head towards the depths of the Iranian territorial waters. All of this took place in an open, controlled, and monitored area within the dominion of the U.S. 5th Fleet units in the Sea of Oman, which operated based on their naval, missile, and air capabilities. However, the Revolutionary Guard Corps units in the second phase of their operation, which was based on expelling U.S. naval vessels from the area and through their quick reaction and immediate response to deal with an emergency and unfamiliar event, proved that they were distinguished by remarkable readiness. The sensitivity of the Iranian intervention through this special operation and the readiness of its navy will inevitably be more dangerous for the U.S. in the event of another confrontation that might just escalate into a broader clash. Hence, Iran was able to emphasize that it is a key and influential player in one of the most sensitive areas in the world. Indeed, it has proven to be the undisputed first player in a strategic clash scene in which the most powerful forces at an international level are involved. Iran asserted that when its interests, national security, and status are exposed to any danger or targeting, it is ready to go above and beyond whatever the level of confrontation is. At a time when we see major powers finding it difficult to confront U.S. influence, whose army is ranked among the strongest in the world, we see that Iran considers confrontation a responsibility, a duty, a right, and a valid option. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The United States continues to play pirates in the Persian Gulf waters through an Iranian-American naval battle which occurred last month in the Sea of Oman when American forces seized one of its oil tankers before the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy was able to recover it with an airdrop, as we saw last week. While U.S. officials have conveyed a completely different story from the Iranian one, saying that Tehran is the one who is holding a Vietnamese-flagged tanker, it seems that all doors were shut to the possibility of reducing tensions between the two sides, especially with America brandishing alternative options, perhaps military ones, they say, forgetting who they are actually going up against. Pentagon first denied that this showdown actually took place, but they were then hit hard when the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps released video footage of the encounter just last week. The footage focuses on Iranian movements to board and direct the ship's course and omits the earlier attempts by U.S. troops to seize the oil. To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Mohammad Sultan Nejad, academic and researcher at Tehran University. Thanks a million for being with us, Dr. Sultan Nejad. Now, the conflict between the Iranian and the American accounts regarding the tanker incident in the Sea of Oman will for sure just exacerbate tension between both sides. But, however, can the Pentagon still refuse, how can they just refute the Iranian narrative and the Iranian story after the visual evidence presented to the entire world by the Iranian state TV?
Okay, thank you for having me. As you just said, we have just conflicting narratives by Iranian and the American sides about this incident. The thing is that at least Iran has showed some evidence to be relied upon, and this is visualized how the things have gone. So this is something that we can at least see some evidence supporting that. But American narrative seems like unsubstantiated, and I have not seen anything more than some claims about what they have said about their own side of the story. The thing is that I think totally what is disappointing is the United States' type of reaction to the waters close to Iran. And this is something that would just make things much worse. And in my opinion, there was like a problem resolved that the United States revived it. And then by such actions of, as you said, can be termed piracy, they are trying to make things even worse and just proposing some narratives that they are not acceptable and they cannot support it. So I'm regretted about what I see in this condition. I think the United States could act more responsibly if it just kept its pledges towards Iran in accordance the nuclear deal, and they didn't hesitate to revive the nuclear deal after the Trump went. And now we see the two countries in such escalations that I don't think would bear any fruits.
Dr. Sultan Nejad, something interesting was said by the Americans after the incident where Washington actually issued a threat last week through its Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, that it might resort to what it called alternative options, maybe including military ones, against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Is that an inevitable option if the two sides fail in the upcoming agreement or in the upcoming talks to try and revive the agreement of the JCPOA?
Well, I think that option would be a remote possibility regarding the facts on the ground. I don't think the United States has the stomach to do such a thing about Iran. Not that the United States does not have the military power to do that, but the consequences would be, you know, very high for the United States, and we all know that Iran has a formidable military and Iran can retaliate in very strong ways. Iran has shown its ability to respond to the United States' aggressions in the past. Just I make a reference to what Iran did with launching the missiles to our United States bases in Iraq that led to like brain injury for many number of Americans. And this was a fact that was seen by the world. So the United States actually hesitates to do such a thing. And again, I would see that if the United States would does this and Iran would respond, it would have like these escalation mounted between the two countries, which is very destructive, especially for the United States, because it is alien to their region, and the United States is already entangled in conflicts in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. The United States has recently managed to take out its troops from Afghanistan, and it would be unwise to start a new war in the region, particularly with a country like Iran, with a formidable military and also a population that is opposed to any foreign interference. So I do not think that that option would just be materialized by the United States. There is a wisdom in the United States. And the fact that the United States has resorted to negotiations with Iran and the negotiations went on, the United States, actually during the Trump administration, has this rationality to recognize Iran's rise, mm-hmm. was just out of the United States' desire to avoid such a destructive eventuality. So I do not think that
Dr. Sultan Nejad, Iran requires for the reversal of steps that were taken by the United States of America for its nuclear program, a complete lifting of the sanctions. This is what Iran wants, because they are basically unilateral, punitive U.S. Measures here in order for them to actually join back the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. While Washington refuses to make any concessions in this regard, who has the higher bargaining hand here, and what is more pressuring measures that we can expect out of the Biden administration?
Well, again, I'm sorry that we're in such a situation that we're talking about these measures and countermeasures, about these leverages. Well, I think there would be much better options, but now that the United States has created such a bad situation and they're continuing this way down to like escalation with Iran, I would say that eventually Iran would have the upper hand, because you know Iran has many options. That when Iran is restricting access of to some sites by for the like the international observers, it means that there are other sites that would be restricted by Iran upon a political decision. And then also you would see that Iran can increase its enrichment, its uranium enrichment level. It's already 60%. It can go higher and higher. The number of centrifuges, the kind of centrifuges can be improved. And all this would work like a leverage for Iran. And it is in a time that the United States has consumed all its options. Actually, the United States has implemented what it calls crippling sanctions towards Iran. But despite these sanctions, you would see that the country is going on there is a heavy pressure on the economy.
So basically, what you're saying is very, very important, but basically in 30 seconds, because we're actually out of time, but in 30 seconds, then why is this kind of negotiating talks important, or what's the actual point out of it if the U.S. cannot commit itself to anything?
Well, I think it's a matter of legitimacy generation and the legitimacy maintenance for Iran. I think Iran has a moral high ground here. Iran has a moral high ground. Everybody knows that Iran is just doing the right thing. Iran has kept its pledges towards the world community. We have all seen how Iran behaved vis-a-vis the United States, unlawful behaviors. So legally, again, Iran has the upper hand. So international legal instruments would support what Iran has done while condemning the United States' unilateral action of withdrawal from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Then again, in the political scene, you would see that there are countries that are supporting Iran's cause. Politically, Iran has the high ground here. China is working with Iran, Russia is working with Iran, Europeans, despite their cooperation with the United States, but at least they are ready to just put some sort of political pressures on the White House to resume its commitments.
Well,
so I think
it seems that we are looking upon some very important couple of months to come between the Islamic Republic of Iran and its U.S. counterpart. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mohammad Sultan Nejad, academic and professor at Tehran University, for joining us on this matter. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, U.S. State Department notified Congress of a new $650 million arms sale to Saudi Arabia last week. The sale comes as the Biden administration continues to grapple with the U.S.-Saudi relationship that has been strained in recent years following the murder of U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi and Saudi Arabia's involvement in its absurd war on Yemen. Now, the sale will include 280 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles, which the State Department said are used for air defense capabilities and cannot be used to attack ground targets. U.S. lawmakers have criticized Riyadh for its involvement in the war on Yemen, while the U.S. is up to its neck in this conflict, which is considered one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters. These same U.S. lawmakers have refused to approve many military sales for the kingdom without assurances that U.S. equipment would not be used to kill civilians. Well, Yemeni cemeteries say otherwise, but when have U.S. officials ever said the truth? Biden reneges on vow to sell arms to Saudi Arabia in this following report.
In less than a week, the U.S. administration approved two arms deals to Saudi Arabia under the pretext of supporting the territorial defense of Saudi Arabia. It is not excluded that the two deals are a leap from the deteriorating relations between the Joe Biden administration and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, which have recently declined further as Washington blamed Riyadh for the high oil prices. The administration's approval of two U.S. arms deals to Saudi Arabia totaling $1.15 billion also coincided with rapid developments on the Yemeni oil and gas-rich Ma'rib front, where the Army Forces and the People's Committees and the Yemeni resistance on Sarullah took control of all the governorate's districts, with the exception of Ma'rib district, which includes the city of Ma'rib, the governorate's center, and the Wadi district. The resistance is now closer than ever to defeating the Saudi-Emirati alliance and its Western backers in the more than six-year-old war, which may explain the dispatch of the American envoy to Yemen, Timothy Lenderking, to the region, where his visits are limited to times when Saudi Arabia feels cornered and defeated to try and salvage the situation. The U.S. Department of Defense had announced last week that the State Department informed Congress its approval of a $650 million deal with Saudi Arabia, which includes 280 AIM-120C medium-range air-to-air missiles. According to the State Department, these missiles are supposed to be used for defense purposes and cannot be used to, quote, attack targets on the ground, unquote, and is fully in line with the administration's pledge to engage in diplomacy, wait for it, to end the conflict in Yemen. I really fail to understand how any of this statement is compatible with simple common sense. But when has America's foreign policy ever made any sense? This deal is the second for Saudi Arabia under the Biden administration. Last week, the U.S. State Department notified Congress its approval of another $500 million military support services package.
At the time, the State Department said the proposed transaction will support the foreign policy and national security objectives of the United States by helping to enhance the security of a friendly nation that remains an important force for political stability and economic growth in the Middle East.
But the agreement, which includes support for the ongoing maintenance of a wide range of helicopters, including a future fleet of Boeing CH-47 Chinook aircrafts, violates Biden's pledge because these aircrafts are offensive ones. They are used to launch AIM-120 air-to-air missiles. To justify this, the State Department claimed that this deal would also provide protection for American soldiers and more than 70,000 American citizens working inside the kingdom, which in reality supports Saudi military aggression against Yemen rather than works to end it.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Washington is Dr. Ziad Al-Hafiz, author and former Secretary General of the Arab National Conference. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Ziad. Now, after it had withheld from selling weapons to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the U.S. State Department has approved the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued up to $650 million, with another package that was also approved last week up to $550 million for Saudi Arabia. So instead of actually pressuring Mohammed bin Salman to at least stop or halt the war, his aggression against Yemen, Biden just gave him 280 more weapons to ignite it even further. How is that finding peace in Yemen, as Biden always likes to say?
Well, thank you for having me on your program. And I think what you have said in your presentation of this segment is totally correct, that hardly ever U.S. foreign policy has made sense. I think the Biden administration is no different from previous administrations, where it says one thing and does exactly the opposite. Because in this particular instance, for instance, the Biden administration is the result of a coalition of forces that have conflicting agendas, and these forces have put him in the White House. But now, chicken has come to roost, so to speak. And let's say the military-industrial complex or the companies that manufacture arms are requiring their pound of flesh, so to speak. And this goes against the peace between quotation marks rhetoric that he was trying to advocate to end the peace, to end the war in Yemen, as well as his colleagues in the Democratic Party in Congress. But the realities on the ground say otherwise, that they have to pay heed to those donors who have made them what they are when they were facilitated the reach to power. The second thing is, in the actual tension that exists between the administration and the Crown Prince, we have seen it reach to almost a climax last week in Lebanon, where the Crown Prince has declared for all intents and purposes an economic war on Lebanon, mm-hmm. and is forcing the council, the Gulf members of the to follow suit and join into the blockade, economic blockade of Lebanon. This goes against to the strategy of the United States and Lebanon, that wants to keep it as it is and not having it collapse, because otherwise it will go indirectly into the sphere of influence of Iran and Hezbollah, and this is what it doesn't want.
What we saw is pretty much either a confusion in the Biden administration or actually a strategy, a new strategy by Biden. Trump administration's friendly, very friendly, if I may, relationship with Mohammed bin Salman and Riyadh, the Biden administration kind of recalculated their approach to Saudi Arabia, which is a country with severe human rights violations. But they are Washington's closest allies in West Asia. So is this Biden's way of maybe upping the ante against Iran, who he will have talks with maybe soon enough?
Well, yes and no. I mean, don't forget that this stance towards Saudi Arabia started with the Obama administration, mm-hmm. When he wanted to recalibrate the whole Middle East, and that was the foundation of the Arab Spring. And the Arab petromonarchies in the Gulf were next in line, so to speak, to follow suit, but it didn't happen. Trump had a personal good relation with the Crown Prince and Saudi Arabia, but that doesn't mean that the administration followed suit and also that the Congress followed suit. So you have to be a little bit careful about how we define the relationship between the various administrations. Biden is a continuation of Obama's administration in that term of having, different perspective from previous administrations about the relationship with Saudi Arabia. Suddenly, for ideological purposes or for any other purpose, the issues of human rights, political freedoms, etc., is becoming at the forefront of his policy with petromonarchies. And I don't think it's going to succeed, because real politics requires that he follows another track. And I don't think there is a strategy in the United States or in the Foreign State Department. They are pragmatic to the point of responding to events on a day-to-day basis without a clear view of what's going to happen next. And this has happened since the invasion of Iraq, where they have lost the initiative and they have become subservient to the events on the ground initiated by their opponents, and they have to decide to how to respond to that. In the present situation, with the various, let's say, hot dossiers that the United States is facing in the region, the discussion with Iran, the issue with Hezbollah, and the war on Yemen, at the center of all this is the security of the state of Israel. So all the policies of the United States are guided to help Israel, which is in a difficult situation because of its inability.
Does this analysis actually maybe support the point of the U.S. envoy to Yemen, Tim Lenderking's visit? He just landed in the region, bearing an initiative apparently aimed at reversing the developments that Ansarullah did in the northern city of Ma'rib in Yemen. Why is it so important for the U.S. that the Yemeni resistance stays put and not fully take Ma'rib?
Because for geostrategic purposes, if you take Ma'rib, you also control the whole of Yemen, and when you control the whole of Yemen, you control the entrance to the Red Sea, and that is a geostrategic no-no for the United States, because all the Red Sea, the Suez Canal, and the access to Europe from that sea lane becomes in the hands of hostile powers to the United States. And that's why it is extremely important for the United States to keep, in the best case scenario, Yemen from falling to the hands of its opponents, and in the worst case scenario, to keep the war dragging as much as possible so nobody can have a direct claim on that geostrategic position, notwithstanding the fact that Yemen is sitting on an ocean of oil and gas, which in contrast or compared to those of the Saudi Arabia, no new discoveries have been made in Saudi Arabia, and therefore it's facing the issue of depletion of reserves. Whereas in Yemen, you may have a new boon for the oil industry. And that's why the issue of Yemen is not just a passing fade and has extremely important strategic
importance. This gives a lot of points, Dr. Hafiz, for how Yemen might actually be the rock that Saudi Arabia might stumble on in the region of the Arabian Peninsula. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ziad Hafiz, former Secretary General of the Arab National Conference, for joining us from Washington to talk about the new U.S. arms deal with the Al Saud in the Arabian Peninsula. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
If we continue not acting against the real cause of the climate crisis, the capitalist mode of production and the capitalist worldview, they will take it as a social license to carry on with collapse, says Joao Camargo, writer, in an article titled "Capitalism's Only Plan for Climate is Collapse." Stay tuned for more. The recent flurry of announcements over ambitious action by governments during the COP26 in Glasgow has been justly received with skepticism by climate justice activists and the general public, and enthusiastic support by the media in general. During this same period, important revelations of the massive gap in terms of necessary emission cuts and countries' plans emerged as the broader rejection of greenwashing became pervasive. The narrative of false solutions and green capitalism doesn't work. Recently, the revelation that over 800 oil and gas wells are being planned for drilling still this year and in 2022, and the report Drill Baby Drill makes it clear that the proceedings of COP26 are mostly propaganda, as the only real mandatory and contractualized plan global capitalism has for the climate crisis is collapse. The scenario is the most dire ever. Not only the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere is at its highest for millions of years, temperatures keep pushing closer to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and emissions are rising once again after the COVID hiatus. The IPCC scientists have leaked the second draft of Group 2 report, which states that estimates of committed CO2 emissions from current fossil energy infrastructure are 658 GTCO2, nearly double the remaining carbon budget, revealing that others, scientists, stress that climate change is caused by industrial development and more specifically the character of social and economic development produced by the nature of the capitalist society, which they therefore view as ultimately unsustainable. In a few months, we will understand the level of political and business editing in the final report that finally comes out. Yet current infrastructure is not enough for global capitalism. In the Drill Baby Drill report, made public by the Glasgow Agreement at COP26 Coalition's People's Summit, a still bigger measure of incoherence appears. There are 816 new oil and gas wells being planned and drilled until the end of the year and in 2022. These are located in 76 countries all around the world, countries whose governments are currently sitting in the halls of COP26 in Glasgow to negotiate a solution for the climate crisis. The host UK appears close to the top of desired new wells, with 36 mostly offshore in the basins of Central Graben, Moray Firth, and North Sea and Shetland. It is very likely that while Boris Johnson was doing his James Bond gag on stage, at least some four wells were being drilled to add to British fossil fuel reserves, making him a sort of meta-Bond villain. The top of the ranking for most wells planned goes to Australia and Russia, with 80 wells each, closely followed by Mexico with 78. Australia, Russia, Mexico, Indonesia, USA, Norway, UK, Brazil, and Myanmar plan to drill over 500 oil and gas wells between now and the end of 2022. The report points out that this is very likely an underestimation. The companies most involved in drilling these wells are the gallery of the usual suspects: Eni, Petronas, Shell, Equinor, Total, Pemex, BP, Pertamina, Chevron, and ExxonMobil. There are at least 67 wells planned above the Arctic Polar Circle. Total and ExxonMobil are in a contest to drill the deepest well ever in the ocean. Total is going for 3,628 meters deep in Angola, and ExxonMobil is going for 3,800 meters deep in Brazil. Many of these companies are spending millions every year on propaganda for carbon neutrality and other false solutions, blocking real action and expanding their operations. The report also includes a sample of wells drilled in 2021 so far, with China on top, followed by Turkey, Russia, Norway, Indonesia, Mexico, Pakistan, Australia, and Egypt, the hosts for the next COP. This shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. It is the way this system operates, just enough propaganda of ambition and techno fixes to keep fossils flowing as ever, while the climate collapses. The information does provide us with a question. If the on-climate change debate is framed by companies and governments around the terms of net zero, carbon credits, carbon taxes and offsettings, rather than stopping emissions, when will it ever come to the real problem of the climate crisis? Well, never. And that is the purpose. Governments and companies are actively engaged in not cutting emissions, but also in effectively increasing them. Each and every one of these wells is a public crime against humanity and all species on this planet advertised in advance. It is good that we know them, though, for it is better to know fossil capitalism's plans to collapse us beforehand and in as much detail as possible. And that is why the call on the report does not go out to governments and fossil companies to suddenly act after over 3 decades of expanding fossil use. The call goes out to the climate justice movement and civil society. Spread this information far and wide. Act on it. Campaign on it. Block, stop, and detain all of these projects. Other millions of fossil and fossil-based projects compose the menu of collapse daily, confirmed by governments and companies. They are the legally binding commitment for our collapse and need to be stopped. The overwhelming agreement on the reason why the climate crisis is not being fixed is becoming as high as the overwhelming scientific agreement on the cause of the climate crisis. The reason why the climate crisis is not being solved is because it will lead to the biggest shift in the power in the history of humanity. It will lead to the biggest transfer of wealth and loss of profits in history. That means very little to the majority of human population, as we will be the beneficiaries of this shift, of this transfer, of this redistribution. If we solve this crisis, we will have the chance to heal our battered planet. That is why their plan means collapse. They refuse to abdicate an inch of their brutal privilege and power. If we continue not acting against the real cause of the climate crisis, the capitalist mode of production and the capitalist worldview, they will take it as a social license to carry on with collapse. Even without social license, their plan will always lead to collapse. It's not circumstantial. It is the core of this system. We need to collapse them.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Since the Cold War, America has thought itself invincible, but it could not stop Iran from seizing an oil tanker in recent days. Whether it couldn't or didn't depends on who you're hearing it from, as well as both sides' capabilities and policy. But hard facts also speak for themselves and appear to have surfaced quite late in Western media. So Iranian forces seized an oil tanker. Can sound hostile, but Iran says all it was doing was taking back what was its own property to begin with. Its action also served as a statement of sovereignty in our strategic southern waters of the Oman Sea. To hear what actually happened, stay with me, Leila Faramaizi, on Iran Today. Looking at the incident in light of rumors, it may sound confusing. A Vietnamese flagged ship captured by Iran with America showing concern. What reads with what? Well, there's plenty of footage speaking for itself, if only folks would have asked. Here's what happened. American forces confiscated a tanker that was carrying a cargo of Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman, and they transferred its consignment of crude oil to another vessel, which they started guiding to an unknown location. Well, the U.S. has sanctioned Iran's oil and economy in general, but the sanctions are illegal by a couple of interpretations of international law, and to Iran, America's act was no more than an act of piracy. Naturally, Iranian forces wasted no time in recovering the oil. Mr. Ghaffari is editor-in-chief at a well-known daily. We visited to hear his well-studied media man's view of what America's timing and relaying of the incident meant.
نکته مهم این هستش که بعضن ابهامی مطرح میشه در خصوص
The important point is that sometimes there is ambiguity about the nationality of the tanker and questions are raised about whether it was an American or Vietnamese vessel. We usually see that some nations use their tankers under other nations' flags, and sometimes the crew members aren't even the nationals of that country. The United States was controlling the ship. It took Iranian oil, transported it to the tanker at sea, and was carrying it towards its own waters. There's no doubt about this, but it has done so under a new appearance and form.
Mr. Ojorlu is an analyst whom we got to have a chat with at the Tehran Strategic Studies Institute. He gave us his take on the oil tanker situation.
Given the general standoff between Iran and America, what's your take on the recent oil tanker situation that occurred close to Students' Day in Iran?
This stick-and-carrot policy is a traditional approach the United States has adopted toward the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we have seen many times that the United States, especially under the recent administrations of President Obama, Trump, and then Biden, has repeatedly stated that they are willing to pursue diplomacy on an international stage. They call for engaging in diplomacy, but in practice, we see they resort to military, security, and political threats to put pressure on the Islamic Republic. This raises a question for the Islamic Republic about whether the U.S. is honest in its words and actions.
Here's how this country's action or reaction went. Iran's forces landed their helicopters on the second vessel's deck and navigated it toward Iranian waters with the oil. The IRGC Navy's drone units, speedboats, and other vessels, meanwhile, assisted the operation. Oil Minister Javad Orji summed it up in explaining America's intentions. Iran's enemies had resorted to the act of piracy after realizing that the Islamic Republic was determined to export its fuel despite the United States sanctions targeting the country, he said. As for whether and how American forces ever present in our regional waters took action or not in response to Iran's reaction, why would the U.S. cause yet another standoff with Iran in snatching its oil just before Students' Day in this country and before the JCPOA revival Vienna talks the U.S. is almost threatening Iran into? The USS Sullivan's DDG 68 and USS Michael Murphy DDG 112, two American destroyers, approached the second tanker. This was to prevent its recapture, but they were warned away by the IRGC Navy. After the heli-borne operation, U.S. forces started pursuing the second vessel with several helicopters and warships, but they stopped short of capturing it, IRGC Public Relations reported. U.S. forces then dispatched more warships to block the vessel that was carrying the stolen crude, but again they stopped short and aborted the operation and area.
The defense and security power of the Islamic Republic of Iran has increased. The Islamic Republic isn't simply making claims. Almost all international and regional observers acknowledge that. Nations boost their military and security potentials to increase deterrence against impending threats. The same seems to have happened in this incident as well. The Islamic Republic has faced the threat and responded to it in the most appropriate way. To that end, it has been willing to conduct a military maneuver. That's because Iran has come to the conclusion that if it does not respond to the U.S.'s excessive demands, the vital interests of the Iranian people will be jeopardized.
If the U.S. expected Iran to sit back and watch, that's exactly what happened to its own forces while Iran did take action. Mr. Asafari is an MP, moderate in some ways. But like most anyone here, he sees no two ways when it comes to oil snatching and a show of force and retaliation.
Our motto is that if there can't be any oil trade in Iranian waters, this can't be applicable solely to Iran. We won't allow them to sell oil in the region if we can't do the same. Our tanker was navigating on its route before it was confronted by a U.S. warship. But the presence of the IRGC's powerful navy made them give up the tanker so we could return to our territorial waters. We did not let them prevent us from selling our oil.
So far, U.S. invincibility seems like no more than a myth. The U.S. still maintains a presence, even throws about its weight on the world stage. It is weighty, but it's no longer the only big boy on the block. Iran is an upcoming power, or at least unafraid or reluctant to bow to imperialism and hegemony.
Yes, I believe that the hegemony of arrogance was broken in the aftermath of February 1979. Until then, no one dared to chant slogans against the United States and protest against Washington. But now, you see when the American president visits Iraq, an Iraqi journalist greets him with a shoe. Or when the president of the United States goes to an Asian, African, or even a European country, people greet him with rotten tomatoes. These behaviors did not exist before the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
And there are two ready-made world powers already out there. That's Russia and China. America may still be the front runner in military might and technology, but it's only a matter of time. Iran has demonstrated how invincibility is a myth in more than one instance, portraying the U.S. as a menace and sponsor of terror more than anything. In January 2020, Nabil Rauk, the deputy head of Hezbollah's executive council, said of Iran's precision missile strikes at U.S. military bases in Iraq in retaliation for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, IRGC, shattered Washington's invincibility myth. And that just marks the start of a possible response. It sent out a message that American targets in West Asia are within reach wherever they are. With the given oil tanker incident, one might wonder, how far could the U.S. have gone in retaliation and why?
If the Americans wanted to react, they would have done so in the 40 years that have elapsed since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. They have been threatening us militarily, politically, and economically for 40 years. They do not dare to take military action, because today the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet is within range of our Zelzal missiles and long-range surface-to-sea and anti-ship missiles.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
What do authorities in Iran say of the U.S. causing an oil incident with this country? And what do the people of the world think about an American presence in all matters global? Let's see through the lens of other media outlets. For a quick media review, I give you Sarah.
Hello and welcome to the news part of the program with me, Sarah Adema. Today we will be looking at some media reviews regarding Iran-U.S. confrontation in the Oman Sea. Our first review here is from Tasnim News Agency. President Raisi says, Iranian nation victorious in face of U.S. hostilities. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi referred to decades of U.S. hostile acts against the country and said that since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the Iranian nation has been the one emerging victorious in the face of these animosities. The U.S. enmity with the Iranian nation goes back not to four, but to 7 decades ago, the president said in a gathering of the people of Semnan, a city 180 kilometers east of Tehran, held to commemorate the National Day of the fight against global arrogance. Raisi said in the first 3 decades, the Americans managed to plunder the Iranian people's assets with coup and support from puppet rulers. However, over the past 43 years after the victory of the revolution, the victor in this battle against the endless enmities of the Americans has been the Iranian nation. He also hailed a recent IRGC Navy confrontation with the U.S. forces in the Sea of Oman and described the Americans' act of piracy as abominable. Let's check out another review from MIH News Agency. Iranian general warns enemies not to test power of IRGC and army. Major General Ghulam Ali Rashid made the remarks among the army commanders in the area of the Zulfaqar 1400 military exercise. Referring to the capabilities and combat readiness of the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran, General Rashid said, "The Iranian army and armed forces are always ready for a strategic, operational, and tactical confrontation with the aim of maintaining the security, stability, and territorial integrity of Iran against the coalition of enemies, specifically the U.S. Zionist coalition." He also stressed, "Iran armed forces, including IRGC or the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and army forces, will respond decisively to any threats by any arrogant and aggressor power at any level and from the origin of any country." Our last review from Trutha reads, "People worldwide name U.S. as a major threat to world peace. Here is why. How is it that people across the globe have come to agree that the United States is now one of the primary threats to world peace and democracy? Having leveled 2 Japanese cities with atomic bombs and established itself as the world's top superpower following the collapse of the international order in the aftermath of World War II, the U.S. quickly became intoxicated by its newfound military superiority. The U.S. soon went on to introduce a doctrine that positions itself as the world's police, dropped more bombs in the Korean and Vietnamese wars than there had been dropped in the whole course of World War II, and orchestrate military coup against democratically elected governments throughout Latin America. It ended up in turn supporting brutal dictatorship and establishing more foreign military bases than any other nation or empire in history all over the globe. In the 20th century, labeling various activities terrorism was one way of rationalizing the use of force. The U.S. did this especially with its allies in response to anti-colonial liberation movements. So the South African apartheid regime called anti-apartheid resistance terrorism, and the Israeli regime did and continues to do the same to Palestinian resistance, however non-violent. The U.S. has armed and defended these states, embracing and promoting the rhetoric of war against terrorism. That's it for me in today's edition, and now, back to you, Leila.
About the American presence and the given October incident, the prominent Palestinian Arab journalist and editor-in-chief of Raya Al-Yom, Abdul Bari Atwan, wrote, "The seizure of Iran's oil shipment by U.S. forces constitutes the most heinous form of official piracy and a public declaration of war against Iran." He believes Iran's response to piracy shocked America, as it expected Iran to put up with the blow and not respond. Whereas the Iranian operation to release its stolen oil shipment carried the message that the country's armed forces are not afraid of any military confrontation with the United States, regardless of the price.
Speaking of what happened in the Oman Sea a week before November 4th, the United States has imposed sanctions on other countries besides us, such as Venezuela, Syria, and several other countries. Given that we are being asked to sell oil and oil condensate, we won't be losing on both fronts. We don't accept facing sanctions and at the same time being forced to surrender our uranium and centrifuges, ending our nuclear activities, and not being allowed to trade oil either.
جمهوری اسلامی به این درک رسیده که هرگاه در مقابل زیاده خواهی
Islamic Republic has come to understanding that whenever it acts reciprocally in the face of American excessive demands and insists on its own principles in that regard, it will achieve more success and will somehow be able to get what it wants, because any time the Islamic Republic has chosen a peaceful policy and made concessions to the US, practically nothing has happened, outside its economy being affected and the other side's demands becoming ever so excessive.
What we've got, and with it we can put a dent in the untouchable ghost that was the sole superpower, America. Say the US spy drone Iran captured after downing it in 2019 by its homegrown air defense missile system called Khordad 3 was one of several chances Iran saw to enrich its military manufacture.
آنچه که در جریان سرنگونی پهپاد گلوبال هاک رخ داد.
We saw what happened during the downing of the Global Hawk drone. The American officials initially announced that the drone has been shot down, so they needed to respond. But soon we saw that the Trump administration officials thought better of it and didn't do anything. The other issue was the airstrike on the Ain al-Assad airbase Iran conducted in retaliation for US assassination of General Soleimani and the Pentagon's subsequent censorship of the fact. The Pentagon tried to hide the fact that 110 of its forces suffered concussions and brain injuries. The reason was that according to the strategies the Pentagon, CENTCOM, and White House have laid out, creating unpredictable tensions with Iran would hurt the US interests.
Talking of competition that'll leapfrog to curb a US military power monopoly, the US's congressionally created National Defense Strategy Commission reports itself that Russia and China possess precision strike capabilities, integrated air defenses, cruise and ballistic missiles, advanced cyber warfare, and anti-satellite capabilities. Also, another congressionally created watchdog group, the US-China Economic and Security Review Commission, reports that China has recently introduced a new stealth fighter, the J-20, and that its growing ballistic and cruise missile inventory can target US bases and surface ships, including aircraft carriers. Also, Russia claimed to have successfully tested a shipborne hypersonic missile that travels at roughly 8 times the speed of sound, which the US apparently has no defense against. Among regional countries and beyond, Iran stands out. It has suffered unprecedented U.S. sanctions and pressure, even assassinations of its nuclear scientists by U.S. ally Israel. Yet, it has stood up to imperialism and hegemony and even managed to greatly resist it. Our guest explains how Iran differs.
Well,
today, the Islamic Republic of Iran has gained considerable capabilities. The capabilities of the Islamic Republic's armed forces are used as deterrents. Our equipment and facilities aren't dependent on any world power, be it Eastern or Western. Our capabilities originate from the inside. We currently have anti-radar missiles. We also have radars that can detect anti-radar missiles. We have armed parts of our sea so we can respond to any threat against the Islamic Republic.
There is no international trade or political relationship with Iran that is not sanctioned by the United States. U.S. sanctions were reinstated in 2018 after America's withdrawal from the JCPOA, particularly those sanctions imposed on the energy, shipping, and financial sectors in November of that year. This caused foreign investment to dry up and hit Iran's oil exports. But Iran succeeded in continuing its economic life and even flourishing in some areas all the same. And this is the main reason that pulled down the U.S. from sitting on the summit to ask Iran to come to the negotiating table.
In the new world, most countries try to make concessions when it comes to the economy and their domestic governance. The Islamic Republic of Iran entered the JCPOA negotiations due to the internal demands, but it was faced with the U.S. reneging on its promises. The Islamic Republic has come to the conclusion that any time it has started a process with the U.S., it has been the American side that disrupted and challenged it.
Sanctions and incarceration have encouraged Iran to reinforce its defenses and work on technological advancement in some fields more than others. Say, with Trump's US's binning of the nuclear deal of 2015 and European parties not managing or wanting to live up to their share of the commitment, Iran revived and unbridled its nuclear program, which it has maintained as peaceful all along, and which it had choked in compliance with the nuclear deal or JCPOA. To mark National Nuclear Technology Day, Iran in April and after the opening week of Vienna talks started feeding gas to cascades of new advanced centrifuges. It also unveiled dozens of achievements to show its nuclear program is peaceful. 133 technological innovations for both medical and civilian use were unveiled. Iran turned to the IR-6 centrifuge, said to be capable of producing 10 times more uranium hexafluoride, UF6, than IR-1.